This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein joins hosts and speaks on topics such as campaign finance reform and revitalizing democracy. Dr. Stein says more people are leaning away from the corporate-sponsored political system and tuning in to the Green Party platforms. We're also joined by Professor Robert Warrior, who will talk about the gutting of the best American Indian Studies department in the country at the University of Illinois. They had 9 professors when Professor Stephen Salida joined. They now have only 1 professor, and Robert Warrior will soon be gone.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Catherine Franke. I'm a law professor at Columbia Law School, and I chair the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, you recently sent me a photo of your parrot Charlie eating bagels and lox. How old is Charlie, and what's their life expectancy?
Charlie's going to be 24 on April 10th. I have his hatch certificate to prove it. Their life expectancy is same as us, human life expectancy. There's a famous story that I read 6 years ago in the London Sunday Times about Winston Churchill's parrot. Churchill, of course, was the prime minister in England many years ago during the Second World War. And his parrot lived on after him. It was passed along to several people, and the reporter for the Times found a person who had the parrot. The parrot was almost 100 years old.
Wow.
And he spoke in Churchill's tone of voice. And you know what he said?
I bet it's X-rated, and we'll have to bleep it.
I can't really say it right on WBAI, but I can imply what he said. He said in Churchill's tone of voice, F the Nazis. Isn't that funny?
That is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's Charlie's favorite expression?
Well, he sings. He sings, enjoy yourself. It's later than you think.
Ooh, prophetic words.
He mocks me. He also sings, get a job. He sings, home on the range. But he messes that one up. He goes, home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope bird is heard. He has about 100-word vocabulary.
Really?
Yeah. The most famous parrot that died 3-4 years ago was a parrot that Irene Pepperberg studied at Harvard. The parrot was called Alex, and Alex could do arithmetic up to 8 figures. It recognized colors and shapes, so it had the power of abstraction. You could put a tray of triangles and rectangles and squares and cubes and spheres in different colors on a tray, and then you could show it to the bird. You say, which one is the red ball? And he would tell you.
Amazing.
It is quite amazing. They say that parrots have a intelligence capacity of around a 3-year-old. So it's like science fiction living with Charlie. Charlie Parker is his name, because he's a bird.
Michael, are you going to have a 25th birthday party for him?
Well, we had a party when he was 18 because we registered him for the draft. And we certainly will have a 25. And
nice.
you and Kathy Davis will be there. I hope you'll be invited.
Looking forward to it. Jill Stein is a physician and activist who is seeking the Green Party's 2016 presidential nomination. She ran for the White House as the Green Party's candidate in 2012, winning nearly 500,000 votes. Stein is a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Medical School. Her campaign website urges, quote, it's time to build a people's movement to end unemployment and poverty, avert climate catastrophe, build a sustainable just economy, and recognize the dignity and human rights of every person. The power to create this new world is not in our hopes, it's not in our dreams, it's in our hands. Welcome, Dr. Stein, to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be with you.
Tell us, if you will, a bit about your background and how you got into independent politics.
Wonderful. Okay. So, you know, I'm a medical doctor by training and by profession.
And now you could say, instead of practicing clinical medicine, I am practicing political medicine, because it's the mother of all illnesses. And basically, I got tricked into running for office about 15 years ago and discovered that there's enormous hunger out there for political integrity, a different kind of politics. And I got very hooked on it myself, having a real honest discussion with everyday people outside of the constraints of the corporate political parties. And just very briefly, as a doctor in the clinic, I was seeing an epidemic of asthma, learning disabilities, autism, cancer, diabetes, obesity, you name it. And this was not only in the clinic, but also as a young mother at the time, seeing in my community this upsurge of illness that we didn't used to have. And to make a long story short, I became involved at the community level trying to address some of the drivers of these epidemics, everything from a sick food system to pollution to poverty and homelessness. These are things we can fix. And what I learned in my political education as a sort of a mother doctor advocate for communities was that we could have great solutions that would provide jobs, improve our economies, improve the health of our communities and workers, but they didn't go anywhere because the legislature, which was 85% Democratic, I might add, was in the pocket. And when we build a broad coalition across labor, across health, across environment, to get money out of politics, we actually succeeded, and we passed a referendum by a 2-to-1 margin to provide public financing and end the addiction of our political system to big money. And what happened after we passed this clean elections law? The Democratic legislature repealed it on a voice vote in a Democratic caucus. And to me, that anchored my future in independent politics, realizing that our lives really depend. We are all in the target hairs right now of a democracy that is massively dysfunctional and is essentially a threat to our health, to peace, to prosperity, and very much to our lives, literally. And we've got to change the political system. That can only happen outside of the hijacked corporate political parties.
Jill, are there, in your view, any fundamental differences between the two parties? Or put in another way, what is shared by the two major parties?
Unfortunately, they share way too much, you know, and you can always find differences around the margins in the way that a Democrat or a Republican, you know, their agenda and their vision. You can find these differences, but on the core issues of our economy, you know, they both support offshoring our jobs, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, NAFTA before that, the depression of wages, the war on the rights of workers and unions. They share that. They share an approach to the climate, which is essentially predatory, delivering the money for their campaign sponsors. So all of the above, which was Obama's energy policy, has actually been more destructive to the climate than George Bush's drill, baby, drill. And in fact, there's been far more drilling done under Obama's all of the above. On the expansion of the wars, Obama basically took George Bush's policies and ran wild with them and massively expanded the wars and the drone policies and you know, this just disaster of regime change, which has become sort of the basis of American foreign policy. So you're not going to find the difference on foreign policy. And on our civil liberties, you know, Obama has been the most regressive, the most oppressive on freedom of the press, on using the old laws on the books to attack journalists and lock them up for simply exercising their responsibilities of investigation and disclosure. And then finally, on immigrant rights, you know, we see in this election how the Republicans are the party of hate and fear-mongering, but what we learned under the Barack Obama administration is that the Democrats, unfortunately, have become the party of deportations, of detentions, and of night raids. Neither of those are acceptable. We have good solutions which are affordable, and in fact that our lives depend on, to all of these problems, but you won't find them in those corporate political parties.
Jill, why do you say we are in this kind of magical moment?
You know, magical but perilous, I would say. You know, magical because it's a big wake-up time. And in fact, the most recent poll from the Wall Street Journal, this was done last summer, showed that half of the American electorate has actually rejected the corporate political parties. Half of Americans, 50%, have basically divorced the Democratic and Republican parties. Republicans are 21%, Democrats are 29%, but they've both basically become minority parties because people have been thrown under the bus. And for quite some time now, many people have been, you know, shall we say, like as if they were in an abusive relationship and were still defending their abuser, that, you know, that you had to keep voting for what was literally killing you and throwing your jobs away and throwing an entire generation into student debt from which there is no exit in the current economy. So many people had been involved in apologizing, you know, becoming apologists for this political abuser. But right now, there is a big wake-up call going out, and we see that reflected. You know, we see that certainly reflected in the Sanders campaign, and in an odd way, we see it reflected also in the Trump campaign, where people have really divorced the Republican establishment. But unfortunately, you know, austerity breeds fear. It breeds the, you know, the right-wing populism that slides into fascism. So it's really important in this magical moment where people are waking up to oppose the system that we stand up for basic human rights, for democracy, for an economy that can meet all of our needs, and for a foreign policy based on international law and human rights that can actually meet all of our needs in a cooperative, global, you know, form of interchange in which we don't seek to dominate everybody, but we become a collaborator based on a system of international law. So it's really critical, as the House of Cards is falling down, you know, before our very eyes, it's really critical for us to resist the fear and intimidation that tells us we have to just sign on for more of the same, when in fact more of the same is a quick trip over the cliff. It's really important for us to stand up for a different way forward based on democracy, justice, and human rights that can actually solve these critical problems we're facing.
We're speaking to Dr. Jill Stein, who is the 2016 Green Party candidate for president. Dr. Stein, you've said that supporting the lesser evil paves the way for the greater evil, that it makes the greater evil inevitable. And you've called this the politics of fear. And I wanted to ask you more about that.
Great. Thank you. Because I think that's sort of what it boils down to, because we really do have the solutions. And in fact, we not only have the solutions, but I think, you know, we reflect the basic humanitarian values of the American public. On poll after poll, there are large majorities, often supermajorities, calling for downsizing the military, for the right to a job at a good wage, for health care as a human right. These are the values that the American people support. They're not reflected in our current political system. Yet, in fact, we reflect that, and by we, I mean we as a broad coalition for justice. We reflect those values. We have the solutions that can actually solve these problems. And the good news is that we actually also have the numbers that it takes to turn this around. And let me just mention briefly here that if you take the number of young people who are in debt right now, that is 43 million young people, and now no longer all young people. Many are well into middle age, who are locked in predatory debt. And 43 million is enough to win a three-way presidential race. And in fact, our campaign is the only campaign that will do the right thing and cancel that debt like we did for the crooks on Wall Street. We need to do that for young people. So if that word alone were to get out and young people were actually to come out and check the green box to cancel student debt, In fact, they could take over this election and move forward this basic agenda for justice. So the name of the game here is not letting them sabotage you with their propaganda of fear. We do have the numbers. We have the power to turn this around. And whether we win the office in this one election, or we simply lay the groundwork and turn out millions of people. It'd be great to get the word out to 43 million, and I wouldn't rule that out, by the way. I think this is possible. But even if we fall short of a win in this election, we can win the day by really beginning the unstoppable movement towards taking back the promise of our democracy. In the words of Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. And in fact, we do have the power. We have the numbers. Don't let them talk you out of it for a minute. In fact, you know, the bottom line here is that the clock is ticking. This is kind of the Hail Mary moment. It's now or never, friends, whether you're looking at, you know, the crash of the economy next time it comes around, which seems to be very soon, or we're looking at the crash of the climate. There are very serious consequences on the very short-term time horizon here. This is a time for us to stand up and reject the lesser evil and fight for the greater good like our lives depend on it, because they do.
Jill, speaking of power, you have what you call a power to the people plan. Can you give us some of the highlights of this political program?
Great. So, you know, there are a couple of key points to it. So one, as I just mentioned, is abolishing student debt. And I can't stress that enough, because this is kind of like the engine of transformation. It's always the younger generation which moves us forward, which really propels us forward at times of great social transition and social transformation. So we need to liberate that younger generation to do their job. And in order to liberate them, we need to get them out of this predatory debt slavery that they are locked in. And I'll just, you know, say again, we bailed out the banks who got us into this mess. It's about time to bail out the students. We can do that with a quantitative easing program, basically, which the president has enormous authority over, because the president appoints the Federal Reserve, who in turn can institute a quantitative easing. And basically, with a stroke of a pen, student debt is history. And that would be not only an enormous stimulus package for the economy, but it would liberate an entire generation to drive that economy forward, to take the risks, to start the small businesses and cooperatives that they need to do to transform the economy, and to really be the visionary who are leading the way forward towards an entire agenda of justice. Now, that broader agenda, let me just mention one major piece of it, which is the Green New Deal. This is like the New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression in the 1930s, but in this case, it's a green form of the New Deal. So it not only revives the economy, it also turns the tide on climate change. And we call basically for 100% renewable energy by 2030, declaring the emergency that we actually have in the state of both the climate and the economy, and creating 20 million living wage jobs to put everyone to work, not only greening our energy system, but also our food, our transportation, and our restoring critical infrastructure, including ecosystems. And this dovetails with an important additional component here of our Power to the People plan. Once you have a green economy, and we call for, you know, completely greening that economy in 15 years, which we can do, by the way. It took us 6 months after the Second World War, after we entered the Second World War with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It took us all of 6 months to transform our economy from 0 to 25% of GDP to a wartime footing. So the emergency we're facing now makes World War II look like small potatoes. So it's time for us also to declare that national emergency, green the economy. One of the benefits of that is that it makes the wars for oil obsolete. in doing so, you know, because you no longer have to fight, or shall we say, you can no longer justify this outrageous fighting, which violates every shred of international law and human rights out there, to be conducting this regime change, this war against terror, which is basically a war for oil. Instead, we are producing that clean energy here at home, clean, infinitely renewable energy at home, and we can no longer justify having over 1,000 bases, military bases, in over 100 countries around the world. So in other words, we can massively cut the military budget, which becomes obsolete, and put those, you know, essentially $500 billion. Let's say we conservatively cut the military budget in half and pour those dollars back into true security here at home. And not only can we do this for our own country, but we can then actually begin to lead the way. Because you look at Russia, for example, who's now carrying the water, shall we say, in this fight against ISIS. And basically, we believe we should have a peace offensive rather than a war offensive here to put an end to the threat of ISIS. But just to point out that Russia has a military budget of $60 billion a year. This is like less than 10%. You know, it's about 5% of the U.S. budget. So countries around the world cannot afford this massive arms race, this race to the bottom of the war machines that we are all involved in, and we should be a part of a, you know, an international movement to demilitarize all of our budgets and address all of our needs for green energy and true security. So there are ways forward. There are treaties that we can work on to that effect. And that is all part of the Power to the People plan. And I'll just summarize that foreign policy component as a foreign policy based on international law, human rights, and diplomacy, rather than a foreign policy based on total military and economic domination, which has been absolutely catastrophic, led to regime change, which leads to failed states, worse terrorist threats, and mass refugee migrations. So we can actually solve all of this by doing the right thing on our foreign policy, on our economy, and on our climate policies.
Jill, we just have a couple of minutes remaining, but I wanted to raise the issue of how you depart from Bernie Sanders' campaign. And you've just talked about foreign policy. Can you speak briefly about Sanders' treatment of Palestinians?
Sure. And just to summarize on foreign policy, where Bernie points to the Saudis as the solution, we point to the Saudis as the cause of the problem. And then we call for a weapons embargo to the Middle East, and that includes the Saudis, who then, you know, redistribute this $100 billion worth of weapons to all other combatants. So the Saudis are basically a shortcut to arming every, you know, nefarious cause out there. So we need a weapons embargo. We've been arming all sides, and we've been the major source of all weapons. You know, we're putting a flamethrower to the Middle East, and then we're trying to fight terrorism. No, that doesn't work. You got to stop arming terrorism to start with. So we should lead the way on an arms embargo and bring the Russians in on this as well. And likewise, we need to start seizing and freezing the bank accounts of those countries who are funding terrorism. The Saudis led the 9/11 attack funding, and they have not yet cleaned up their act, as Hillary Clinton herself said in a recent, in a 2009 State Department cable that was leaked by WikiLeaks. She identified the Saudis as still the major funding of global terrorism. So we need to start, you know, putting our money where our mouth is, and let's start impounding those funds. And, by the way, stop funding terrorism ourselves, which the CIA and the U.S. government have been very involved in. And then, other differences with the Sanders campaign on the Palestinians. Yes, you know, we need to follow and lead the way on a foreign policy that supports international law and human rights. So that means not only stopping the sale of arms to Saudis, it means to stop funding the Israeli government, which has been massively violating human rights, international law, and committing war crimes. We are currently funding the Netanyahu military to the tune of $8 million a day, which enables them to conduct these periodic massacres, as well as a host of other violations of human rights, the home demolitions, the occupations, et cetera, the apartheid government. So, you know, again, we need to put our money where our mouth is on human rights, on international law, and to start building from the work that has been done by the grassroots human rights groups in Israel and in Palestine to actually start building trust, to start building confidence, and to start developing real solutions for the long haul for a society founded, and a Middle East, and a world, really, founded on human rights and international law.
Dr. Stein, I have a question to ask you about Bernie Sanders.
Sure.
I think on the one hand, legitimatizing the word socialism is good. It's no longer a dirty word, and I think that reflects sentiment in the United States. About half the people, they don't like what's happening, and they think that's capitalism, and therefore they have a favorable impression of socialism. But my concern about Bernie Sanders is, and he's already promised to do this, that if he loses, which is likely, if he loses the primaries, he's going to throw his support and give over his mailing list to Hillary Clinton. And my question to you is, what do we do about that? How do we organize ourselves both in the electoral arena and outside of it to prevent that kind of, I guess you could call the Democratic Party the cemetery of social movements? What do we do if in fact this happens with Sanders?
You know, I think, and you're absolutely right, and I think the name of the game is to do all we can to help pave the way for Sanders supporters. And many of the supporters of my campaign are also Bernie supporters. And I say, you know, yes, go for it. You know, do what you can. Although personally, I have long since given up on the Democratic Party. And I think any realistic view of history would argue that the revolution will not be televised, and it also will not happen inside of the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party has a kill switch for revolt. And there have been a series of principled campaigns for president inside the Democratic Party, whether you're looking at Jesse Jackson's campaign, which, you know, was a very inspired and powerful campaign running on the strength of the civil rights movement, won 12 major Midwestern primaries, and then he was sabotaged by the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, that basically conducted a smear campaign against him, and accused him of being anti-Semitic, and basically brought him down in the polls and neutralized him. You know, Dennis Kucinich, they got rid of him by redistricting him. Howard Dean, when he was showing strength as an anti-war candidate, they did a smear campaign against him, you know, the Dean scream, so-called, and brought him down. So, you know, they will find a way, and they already have, you know, really tilted the playing field against Bernie's campaign. Furthermore, there have been real efforts to reform the Democratic Party and turn it into a Democratic Socialist Party when the Dixiecrats were basically kicked out during the civil rights movement. There was a real effort between labor and the civil rights movement to focus on the Democratic Party and make it a progressive party. And that effort basically fell apart with the Vietnam War because the Democratic Party is a creature of the military-industrial complex. You know, at the end of the day, they fake left and they go right. You know, they fake left with their progressive campaigns that they allow to be out there in the airwaves, but then they go right in that they are more and more dependent on the big money. They become more corporatist, more militarist, more imperialist. So you're absolutely right. This is not, you know, a socialist, by definition, needs to have a global view of things. And I would say the same thing is true of anyone who claims to be, you know, a proponent of workers' justice or environmental justice or racial justice. The borders do not separate us. You know, we cannot have a secure America unless we have a secure world. And this is where, you know, our policy differs from Bernie's policy. We really see us embedded in a global community. We need global justice. I think it's really important for us to reach out to our friends in the Sanders campaign and just, you know, to urge them to have a plan B ready to go. Many of them are seeing the writing on the wall. We're seeing basically our Facebook page is surging right now. The energy and interest coming into our campaign is just enormous, especially as young people get wind that we're the only campaign that will cancel debt. Bernie won't do that. You know, he won't actually cross the Rubicon on many issues where there are real solutions available. He just can't do it. He's constrained by the Democratic Party, and even if he were to get the nomination, and even if he were to win, he'd be very limited working in partnership with the Democratic Party, which would really hold him back. So the bottom line is I really urge people to go to my website, jill2016.com, and to be a part of building independent politics and to understand that this needs to be a movement for the long haul. You know, what Bernie has said by way of endorsing Hillary and working for Hillary is just not consistent with the world that we need, a world that works for all of us, a world that's not founded on making war on the rest of the world and exploiting workers and all the rest of the baggage, you know, and being a good friend to the banks that Hillary Clinton is, and to Walmart for that matter. You know, she may talk the talk a little bit, but she has a very long walk behind her that needs to be looked at and not forgotten. So, you know, my hope is to welcome with open arms the many Sanders supporters who are going to be looking for a place to go when we see, you know, as they begin to see that Bernie's days are numbered.
Jill Stein, it's really been a pleasure to chat with you this morning, and we wish you the best of luck and look forward to following events of the upcoming months.
Well, thank you so much, Heidi and Michael. Wonderful talking with you, and thank you both so much for your wonderful work.
And thank you. Keep up the campaign. You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Robert Warrior, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit, if you will, about your own background and how the American Indian Studies program got started at the University of Illinois.
Okay, sure. Let me start with myself. I'm a member of the Osage Nation, which is a tribal nation in Oklahoma, and I have an educational background in communication and religion, and a PhD in systematic theology from Union Theological Seminary in New York. I never really pursued the highest levels of theological learning, although that's a really great place to have a degree from. I started focusing really on the written tradition of American Indians using writing to represent themselves, their point of view, their perspectives, and their experiences, starting in really almost from the time of the encounter with Europeans. But in North America, really in the 17th and 18th centuries into the 19th century, I became really interested as a student in graduate school with how it was that American Indian people would try to further their own political, social, economic, goals and how they would seek to persist as American Indian people and peoples through their engagement with the modern world, and primarily through writing. So I became something of a scholar of American Indian writing, American Indian literature, and I didn't know that I would become an academic, but that's what I did, and I ended up here at the University of Illinois after several other jobs, most immediately before this at the University of Oklahoma, where I was in the English department and the Native American Studies program there, and came here in 2008 to direct what was a relatively new 3 or 4 year old American Indian Studies program here at Illinois. Illinois got into the academic field of American Indian Studies through a controversial history with its retired athletics tradition of Chief Illiniwek, which in 2007 the university decided to no longer officially use Chief Illiniwek as a racialized American Indian themed mascot. This was a nearly 20-year controversy that went on with the university here locally, but it was really a national controversy, a national story, and this was in many ways the ground zero of the controversy over the use of American Indian mascots in college athletics in the United States.
Well, let me ask you this, Robert.
Sure.
I assume that you knew Stephen Salida, and you may have been instrumental in inviting him to apply for a professorship at the University of Illinois. Am I correct about that?
I was at the University of Oklahoma when Stephen was there. Actually, he was a graduate student. He was an advanced graduate student when I arrived in the year 2000. He was nearly done. He wasn't taking classes anymore, as I recall. But I was on his dissertation committee. He had someone else who was the director of his dissertation committee. I had met him when I was interviewing for my job at Oklahoma. We became acquainted. He was very interested in my work because I had previously written about the connection between American Indians and Palestinians, about the story in the Hebrew Bible about the conquest of Canaan and its connections to what we can think of as the New Canaan in the New World, and the historical connections between the stories of indigenous peoples in the Middle East and indigenous peoples in the Americas. And I had also been a student of Edward Said when I was in New York at Union Seminary. I crossed the street to Columbia, took classes with Edward Said, which, as you can imagine, those were some of the most amazing experiences and formative experiences for me intellectually.
I can certainly imagine that. So you knew Stephen, and Stephen, after he graduated from the University of Oklahoma, went to teach in Virginia, and then he came in 2014. He gave up his tenured job in Virginia, and he came to the University of Illinois. That's where it hit the fan. He was fired before he could even start because of his opinions on the Israeli bombardment and murder of people in Gaza. And you were one of his chief defendants. And I wanted to bring the story forward and ask you, after Stephen was not allowed to take the job that he had contracted to take, then there was lots of controversy at the university. They were condemned by the American Association of University Professors. Stephen started and won a lawsuit, went to work in Lebanon. You're still there. And my question, Robert, is what happened to the Department of Indian Studies at the University of Illinois after Stephen left?
Well, as I've represented fairly recently to administrators here, it's a story full of dread and great sadness. The American Indian Studies program at Illinois, which had become a leading program internationally, one of the programs that I would say you can't evaluate your own program, but you can hear what people are saying about you. And I would often say to people before this controversy, I would say, I don't know if we're the best program in the world, but I don't hear anybody saying that there's one better than us. And that was my experience of being the director of American Indian Studies here at Illinois. And the search where Stephen was identified as a candidate, and where we ended up making him an offer, and the offer was accepted. That search was one that was a very extensive national search that had an unusually large candidate pool for a search in our field of Native American and Indigenous studies. We had just a lot of really great candidates, multiple finalists. So this was in many ways the next step for us in what had been a rise to prominence of American Indian Studies at Illinois. And what was I think so interesting to a lot of people, including me, about the rise of our program was that it was happening here at this place that had been ground zero for this controversy over sports mascots, and that we were created in many ways as a proactive response on the part of administrators to say, what can we do absent retiring the chief, retiring the former mascot? What is it that we can do to start doing something positive in this area? And created our program and also then a student services program called Native American House. And these two things were started essentially together. When I first came, I was the director of both of them on the campus. And from there, just by the good fortune and hard work by a lot of people, a really great group of faculty had assembled here. Before I came, one of the reasons I decided to come was because there were a lot of really good people already here. And it was a small group, but it was a very promising group of faculty who were already making a mark in the academic world. One of the hallmarks that's really important, I think, for this story of what we were doing at Illinois when I arrived was that we were trying to really embrace a really broad agenda in Indigenous studies globally. This is in many ways the culmination of many of the processes that led to the UN's adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And we self-consciously in our program saw an embrace of a worldwide agenda around Indigenous studies and Indigenous peoples, not just in the U.S., not just even in North America with Canada and Mexico, but also in South and Central America, Aotearoa, New Zealand, Australia, and other places as well, was a hallmark of what we were trying to do to break out of a U.S.-based American Indian Studies model. We had, before the hiring of Stephen, we'd had two scholars from the Pacific join us, and they were Vince Diaz and Christine Delisle. Tina, Christine is a Chamorro scholar who has a background in history and women's studies and studies the role of Chamorro women, the indigenous people of Guam, under modernity and how modern identities of Chamorro women have come about through healthcare education. Vince does incredible work around canoeing and navigation systems, sort of scientifically based indigenous studies work. And Stephen was going to then really add to this mix with his specialty in American Indian literature, which he has a credential in American Indian literature from the University of Oklahoma, which is one of the few places surely the only place you can get that particular credential in American Indian literary studies. And then his ongoing interests, of course, in Palestine and Palestinian American experiences. This was to us a further step forward into what had been a long-standing commitment within our program from the very start, which had been to embrace the very furthest cutting edge of work in Indigenous studies.
Robert, I would imagine that with all the work you did to build this department with these individuals, that it would have a very unfortunate impact on students who were attracted to the university for just the kind of brilliance that you've described. Can you talk briefly about, did the Salida situation impact enrollment, the controversies that you've described? How did the students get impacted by this?
Sure. I think it's a great question. For both students and faculty, the controversy became the only thing that we were doing from August 1st, 2014, forward into this academic year. For our students, it was devastating, mainly graduate students. The graduate students who were here to work with people in our program, those students were especially impacted in really negative ways. It was an incredibly difficult experience for those students, and for every moment of energy they were spending working towards trying to address the immediate situation in front of us regarding Stephen. That was also a time that they weren't able to spend on the studies that they had come here to do. And of course, without Stephen here, for some of them, for everybody, that was one less person who was here to work with. But for our faculty as well, our faculty were also very much wrapped up in this. This was the thing we were doing from August on. And we were really defending our program and the things that we had achieved against the decisions of the university. And from the start, I have to say that it felt very much like, to me, from the start, from the kinds of responses I was getting from administrators, from other people on campus, I was fearful early on, and I became more and more fearful, and then it became really clear that a lot of people on campus either blamed us for what was going on or decided that, regardless of whose fault it was, that we were worth sacrificing over this controversy, people wouldn't show up and defend us. They wouldn't come and say, we have one of the best Native studies programs in the world. We really need to stand in and defend it. We had lots of great colleagues around campus in the humanities, some of the social sciences, and some other places on campus who really staunchly have defended us, have been here for us. But so many other people on campus have just been completely callous towards our program that where we are now as a program is a reflection of, I think, the indifference of the university and the real hostility as well for many people on campus and in the community.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Robert. So what happened to the program? Because it's no longer what it was back in 2014 when Stephen was hired. It's really turned into its opposite. And I wanted to ask you how the program stands today.
It's a dire discussion. The program goes from having at the time that we were bringing Stephen in, we were going to have a head count of eight people in our core faculty. By the time that same spring, we had one person who had decided to leave, and so this was really before the controversy started. It had many things to do with, I think, the ongoing lack of institutional support here for our program, why that faculty member decided to leave in the fall and in the immediate aftermath of Stephen's unhiring, which was, of course, a loss of another one of those people. Another faculty member decided to move her appointment at the university to another department to essentially get out of the way of the controversy, and has now decided to go on to another university. Then the two scholars from Guam that I mentioned, they have moved to the University of Minnesota to the American Indian Studies program there.
So now we're down to three people.
There still should be four. So it may have been nine at some point in there. It should have been nine instead of eight. But then that did leave four people two of the other people last year had job offers from other places, and they decided to stay. Each of them had multiple job offers. They decided to stay, but they also decided they didn't feel like they could continue getting their work done in this program, given what the university had done to disrupt really the work inside of our program. So they moved to other departments, and then that really left two of us when this year started. So another faculty member, the other person besides me, has made arrangements to also move her appointment out of American Indian Studies, which just leaves me, and I won't be in American Indian Studies as of the fall either. So we're now from 8 or 9 people, I'd have to go back and count just to get the exact numbers right, we go down to 0. There's nobody scheduled to be in a tenure-track faculty member in American Indian Studies or an adjunct faculty member in American Indian Studies as of August 16th, 2016.
That's a truly terrible account. You know, you think about this country being founded first on the genocide against the native population and then secondly on slavery. And that is really a fundamental understanding for anybody getting an education in college in America. And now, with the obliteration of your department at the University of Illinois and the single that it sends out to the rest of the universities around the country, that kind of fundamental understanding is not so easy to get anymore. And we've got to wind this up now, Robert, because we're coming to the end of our allotted time. But I wanted to ask you what your last thoughts are in this whole situation.
Yeah, well, I think that one thing that Vince Diaz, who is now at the University of Minnesota, has said that has written about is that we should feel terrible about what's happened, but we also shouldn't necessarily be very surprised. That sometimes those of us who are in the academic world are too easily seduced into thinking that these are institutions that will support us, that will help us. But we really live in a society where we see the erosion of all of these situations and places, locations, sites where we can do the kind of really critically important work of telling the truth, of giving an honest account of not just who we are, but where we've been, of our histories. And that the powerful forces that are arrayed against us are real, and that we have to take these things seriously. The ivory tower is not an ivory tower anymore. It's really something different, if it ever was something different. And that I still think that a lot of the people who are doing scholarship that is so critical, that are making the connections to a real world of real people living in real time. These are people who are fighting within institutions for the kind of spaces that allow them to continue doing that work. And I think as part of a large array of people and locations that are creating the kind of things that you all have your radio show to highlight, we're all together in this, and I think that we have to fight for each other as much as we can.
We're all in this together. I think if I had one watchword, I would say that. Professor Robert Warrior, you have our great admiration for your activity and your scholarship. We thank you for being on Law and Disorder, and we wish you well in your future endeavors. Thanks again.
Thanks very much, Michael and Heidi. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thank you. Take it easy.
I shall not be moved like a tree planted by the water. I shall not be moved.
Michael, hard to believe it's nearly April, and something's coming down the pike.
Yeah, the Brooklyn Folk Festival for the 8th year in a row, April 8th through 10th at St. Anne's Church. You get all the information on BrooklynFolkFest.com. There's going to be freedom songs of the civil rights movement, old-time jam sessions, puppet show, square dance, swing dance, and the world-famous banjo toss. So check out the Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 8th to 10th at St. Anne's Church, and that's brooklynfolkfestival.com. See you there.
On my way to heaven, I shall not be moved like a tree planted by the one. I shall not be moved. Going to meet my mother, I shall not be moved. Going to meet my mother, I shall not be moved. Like a tree planted by the water, I shall not be moved. On my way to heaven, I shall not be moved. On my way to heaven, I shall not be moved. Like a tree planted by the water, I shall not be moved.
All right then. You want to sing one? High bass one?
He's going to put your work walk.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Hurt us at home, beat us at school.